Welcome to the Depth Dive. Today, we're plunging into a really complex story, trying to extract the knowledge that genuinely informs. We're thinking about those huge grand visions, you know, the massive projects that promise to reshape nations, connect communities, maybe even ignite economic prosperity. Think about the excitement, the sheer ambition that goes with some of the world's biggest undertakings. And today, we're taking that deep dive into one specific project, High Speed 2. Or HS2, right here in the UK. Now, this was once talked about as Europe's largest infrastructure project, but its journey has been anything but smooth. We're drawing from a comprehensive source that lays out its really complicated history, the fierce political battles, and importantly, the profound lessons learned along the way. So our mission today is to unpack the core concepts behind this mega project. We want to understand how those initial ideas evolved, or frankly, in many cases, how they unraveled, and explore what this whole story tells us about the challenges of building genuinely transformative infrastructure in the modern world.
Okay, let's try and unpack this then.
If you look at Britain's railway heritage, you might ask, why did a country that basically pioneered railways suddenly need a brand new high-speed line in the 21st century? The source paints a pretty vivid picture here. A Victorian-era rail network literally splitting at the seams, that's the phrase used. It describes these 200-year-old tracks being increasingly expensive and inadequate, especially up the West Coast and across the North. So this wasn't just about adding speed, was it? It was about a core network just hitting its physical limits.
That's precisely the fundamental problem, isn't it? The core concept here is that the existing infrastructure, railways and roads, particularly in the Northwest, was just profoundly inadequate. It couldn't cope with the increasing movement of goods, of people. And this wasn't merely an inconvenience, it was actively hampering economic growth outside London and the Southeast. So for a nation with such a rich rail history, it really forces the question, how did Britain let its vital infrastructure become, well, more of a relic than a foundation for modern development? It points towards, I think, a historical lack of integrated long-term national planning.
And the source actually identifies a real pivot point for this kind of thinking right after the 2008 financial crisis. Former Prime Minister Gordon Brown had what the source calls a Damascene conversion, a sudden profound change of perspective. He realized the UK's dangerous over-reliance on London's financial services. It was stark. And he saw a major infrastructure project as a critical way to try and rebalance wealth across the country. He recognized these old tracks just couldn't support that kind of shift.
Exactly. And this really highlights how external economic shocks can force a major reevaluation of national strategy. The UK's dependence on its capital city was, frankly, something of an outlier in wealthy Europe. Brown believed a project like HS2 could fundamentally shift that dial, you know, lay the foundations for rebalancing the wealth gap between London and cities like Manchester. That gap was far greater than, say, between Paris and Lyon in France. His realization built directly on that understanding that the existing creaking infrastructure couldn't possibly facilitate this essential economic rebalancing.
So out of this kind of urgent need for both capacity and economic rebalancing stepped forward Lord Andrew Adonis. He's described in the source as a train geek, someone with a really passionate vision. He wanted Britain to emulate its European neighbors, France, Germany, Spain, aiming for a modern, integrated European-style network rather than constantly making do and mending the old system. He genuinely saw high-speed rail as his personal transformative legacy, believing Britain absolutely had to catch up.
The concept of that passionate champion. It's absolutely crucial for these grand projects, isn't it? Especially once that underlying rationale finally gets some political traction. Adonis moved fast. He set up HS2 LTD in 2009, tasked civil servants, engineers to come up with a plan, and quickly. However, that initial estimated cost of, and I quote, an entirely notional £30 billion.
Notional, right.
And a distinct lack of early public consultation on the route itself. Well, in hindsight, those were massive red flags. They really foreshadowed many of the future challenges the project would face. It illustrates how quickly an ambitious vision, if rushed, can hit serious practical and political hurdles.
Right. And despite that initial sort of cross-party support for Adonis's big vision, the commitment to HS2 often felt politically expedient. Conservative Prime Minister David Cameron and his Chancellor George Osborne, they enthusiastically backed it. They touted it as a route to jobs, growth. But the source indicates that right from the start, there wasn't actually much clarity on what the new railway was really for. This led to shifting objectives over time, something described as a fatal flaw for projects by Bent Flyvberg, who's cited in the source. This initial ambiguity, kind of born from that rush planning, it built on the notional budgeting, didn't it? Setting a really perilous precedent.
That's such a critical point. When the core rationale for a project isn't clear, isn't consistent, it inevitably makes it more vulnerable. Vulnerable to political winds, to the shifting priorities of different governments. And we saw that. The argument for HS2 kept changing. Sometimes it was capacity, then it was speed, then regional integration. And rebalancing the economy often felt like a footnote rather than the central unwavering purpose. This fundamental ambiguity just compounded the challenges, the ones that originated from that initial lack of consultation and the notional budgeting. It made HS2 a target, not a national imperative.
But while that sort of grand national vision was taking shape in Whitehall, it was really on the ground in places like the Tory heartlands, the Chiltern Hills, where the project truly hit a wall. Fierce opposition. The source talks about locals like Emma Crane and her neighbors organizing with Obama tactics, no less, dissecting this staggering 50,000-page environmental report. There was huge public outrage over the route cutting through an area of outstanding natural beauty, an AONB. This wasn't just, you know, not in my backyard. It felt like a deeply organized, direct response to this imposition from the top.
Yeah, it was a classic clash, wasn't it? Top-down industrial planning versus rising citizen power and direct action, often amplified hugely by the internet. The government's approach, decide, announce, defend, which really flowed from that initial lack of consultation at profoundly alienated communities.
Right.
It's such a stark contrast to how other countries handled similar things. Spain, for example, often took a build first, ask questions later approach, perhaps. China simply wasn't bothered about wildlife or displacement. This difference meant HS2 eventually undertook these meticulous and incredibly costly environmental mitigations. Like that now infamous multi-million-pound bat tunnel.
Ah, yes, the bat tunnel.
It became a symbol, really, of the project's spiraling costs and its difficulties in actually engaging properly with the public.
And that leads us, I suppose, directly into another major pitfall the source identifies: financial mismanagement and intense scrutiny. The Public Accounts Committee, the PACUS, under Margaret Hodge, became a major force, questioning the project's very foundations. She apparently sniffed a grandiose, overblown project and questioned whether the civil service was even fit to oversee something of this massive scale. The source details how the engineering firm Atkins double-counted benefits by $8 billion, and neglected disruption costs, while civil servants were actually accused of lying to justify the project. This financial obfuscation, building directly on those initial vague cost estimates, just further eroded trust, didn't it? Added to the project's already unstable footing.
Margaret Hodge's observations really hit on a persistent issue identified in the source. This lack of capacity in the civil service to manage major projects.
Yeah.
The Department for Transport, for instance, had plenty of policy experts, sure, but a notable absence of senior engineering roles. This led to an over-reliance on external consultants. And as we saw with Atkins, they sometimes provided flawed data or, well, perhaps they were incentivized to present an overly optimistic picture. It's a fundamental question. How can these mega projects possibly succeed without deep internal expertise within the government bodies tasked with overseeing them? This lack of internal capability stretching all the way back to Adonis's initial rapid setup, it just compounded the financial problems and fed directly into public skepticism.
And while Britain was grappling with all these internal battles, political, financial, public opposition, other nations were forging ahead, it offers quite a sharp contrast. The source takes us back to 1964 Japan, the Tokaido Shinkansen, the world's first high-speed electric railway opening alongside the Tokyo Olympics. It was presented as a national mission, a symbol of post-war economic miracle. Then you have France's TGV in 1981, a socialist president's mission to bring progress to all corners of the country, Spain's AVE, heavily funded by the EU, uniting disparate regions after dictatorship. And China, of course, built the longest high-speed network in the world with just extraordinary speed, linking megacities for economic and strategic control. These were projects tied to a really clear purpose, a consistent vision, unlike HS2's shifting, ambiguous goals.
Yeah, what's fascinating there is how these international projects were often tied to an absolutely undeniable national purpose or major event. And in many cases, strong state control and a long-term vision were key. European governments, for instance, invested heavily in training their own engineers, developing their own technology. They truly embraced railways as a strategic national asset. This proactive, integrated approach, seeing railways as integral to national development, it stands in stark opposition to Britain's fragmented project management and those shifting political priorities we discussed. It really illustrates a foundational difference in how these huge undertakings were conceived and executed, contrasting sharply with the issues we saw developing and compounding with HS2.
But interestingly, the source points out the UK wasn't entirely alone in its difficulties with high-speed rail. It highlights similar disastrous projects in the US, specifically California's bullet train, and notable failures to even get projects off the ground in Australia and Canada. It suggests that maybe Anglo-Saxon regulated market-based economic models might be a common thread here, building on Britain's historical laissez-faire approach to railways back in the Victorian era.
That observation's spot on. And it leads us to a really fascinating systemic question. Are there inherent challenges baked into certain democratic or economic models that make building this kind of transformative infrastructure particularly difficult? The UK's historical laissez-faire approach, where the government largely didn't suggest national planning or even really check economic viability back then, that contrasts so sharply with the state-led European approach that successfully built integrated networks. This historical context, it provides a deeper understanding of the difficulties seen today, as later concepts like market-led development continue to clash with that enduring need for strategic, perhaps more centralized state planning for major infrastructure.
And all these accumulating issues, the shifting goals, the opposition, the financial mess, the lack of expertise, they really culminated in what the source just calls the Euston fiasco. This central London station became this potent symbol of overambition and rampant cost overruns. From Chancellor Osborne wanting to emulate Hong Kong's extraordinary West Kowloon station, which cost, nearly $11 billion, far more than Euston's initial budget, to just an unmanageable station design, it was, a mess. Described as four separate projects run by four different organizations with no clear narrative or vision.
Exactly.
It perfectly reflects the project's broader issues, doesn't it? Shifting goals, no coordination. Coordinated leadership, ballooning costs, all concentrated in one critical hub.
That's it, precisely. Euston became the poster child for what happens when ambition isn't grounded in practical reality. How did such a critical hub become so chaotic, so expensive? Well, the immense difficulties of building in densely populated central London, sure. But couple that with a lack of coordinated leadership, ever-changing designs. It just led to continuous delays and these astronomical costs. Hundreds of millions spent just on scrap designs.
Beautiful.
And that underlying concept, the idea of trying to make every station an iconic destination rather than a purely functional transport hub, that contributed significantly. This is what gets called gold plating, isn't it?
Yeah.
Adding excessive features, unnecessary high-spec finishes, which without that deep internal expertise to challenge it, just massively inflated costs, building directly on those initial notional budgets.
Yeah. And the narrative in the source then moves towards the final axe falling on significant parts of the project. By late 2018, the political atmosphere was described as febrile. HS2 was truly unmoored, having lost its initial clarity, its momentum. The source reveals Alan Cook's stock take uncovered a dysfunctional board, poorly understood costs, indicating the budget was off not by millions, but by billions.
Billions.
Despite Boris Johnson giving it the initial go-ahead in February 2020, then COVID-19 hit, leading to more delays. Then came what's described as the secret decision by Rishi Sunak and his advisor Andrew Gilligan to cancel the northern leg to Manchester and significantly scale back Euston and 2023. This felt like the brutal culmination of all the previous issues, the political instability, the financial woes, the lack of a consistent vision, and ultimately a complete breakdown of trust.
It dramatically demonstrates the immense vulnerability of these mega projects to political short-termism, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And to internal government wrangling. Those cost-plus contracts where the government essentially covers all rising costs, they profoundly disincentivized efficiency. They allowed budgets to just inflate almost unchecked.
Right.
And places like Crewe, which had, as the source says, bet the bank on HS2 for regeneration, for new jobs, they were just left abandoned. It highlights this concept of political betrayal and the immense cascading consequences for local communities. And that act of salting the earth, quickly removing the safeguarding from the canceled land, that also prevents any easy future revival. It makes addressing those underlying needs significantly harder down the line.
Yeah.
It's really a story of cumulative failures leading to a devastating outcome.
Wow. Okay, so this deep dive into HS2, despite all its painful lessons, it really offers vital insights, doesn't it? For anyone involved in undertaking monumental infrastructure projects, it feels like a story we can all learn from.
Indeed. What the HS2 saga vividly underscores, I think, is how political expediency, rather than a consistent strategic vision, can fatally compromise a mega project's core purpose right from the start. Those shifting rationales just made it a moving target.
Absolutely. And it highlights the profound dangers of political pressure to maybe minimize initial cost estimates, coupled with that critical lack of robust internal government expertise. That combination inevitably creates a pathway to catastrophic overruns and, crucially, public distrust. We saw that with the notional budgets and the PXA's later scrutiny.
Mm-hmm. Furthermore, the experience just screams out for early, meaningful public engagement, genuine collaboration with local communities, rather than that decide, announce, defend approach that proves so costly, both financially and, perhaps more importantly, in terms of social cohesion. That opposition wasn't just noise. It was a fundamental reaction to feeling ignored.
Yeah. And finally, it's just crystal clear that consistent political will and genuine accountability across successive governments are absolutely paramount. Without them, even a project with truly transformative potential driven by real underlying needs can become what the source starkly described as a multi-billion pound bleeding stump. Righto. These lessons aren't isolated incidents, are they? They're interconnected failures, each one building on the last. So as we look ahead, as we face future national challenges, climate change adaptation, ongoing economic rebalancing HS2, despite its troubled journey, despite its significant truncation, still stands as Britain's only ongoing infrastructure project with that potential to be truly transformative. How do we ensure the profound lessons from HS2's incredibly rocky path aren't just recorded in reports somewhere, but are truly learned, truly applied? How do we build a future that actually delivers on its promises without just repeating the mistakes of the past? It's a question for all of us, I think, looking ahead.